So welcome back, Kathy, and welcome everyone to the second part of this pelvic floor health and anatomy course. Thank you all for joining again, and I'll hand straight over to you, Kathy.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you folks for joining again. Super excited to be here as usual. You guys know who I am already because you've seen part one, and so you know what to expect as far as me and what I have to offer. I wanted to share with you guys a story because I treat a lot of people with pelvic floor dysfunctions as you do folks. And I do have some unique things to share from an anatomical perspective and from a very personal perspective of having failed pelvic floor traditional therapy. And I think it needed to be supplemented with some of the things that I have learned to supplement. And it works really well. I had a patient contact me, and she's an idealist, which is what I call people that take the ID coursework. And it was fascinating. We had an intrinsic core webinar last weekend. And so I booked an appointment with her for telehealth after. And she's a fascinating human. She's really, really great. And she had went away from our treatment plan a little bit and had decided to do some internal self-release. And the next day she felt infinitely worse. And you know, I talked to her about it because it's kind of hard to be subjective and objective at the same time. You may know how to do some of our standard operating system and ID, and when it applies to you, sometimes it's hard to see from an objective lens. And so, which is, I'm assuming, why she books appointments with me. So she was wondering why she rebounded so harshly. And we talked about it. And I want to reiterate what we talked about last week, that sometimes people have like tension in tissues, and particularly pelvic floor, perineum, and anal area, and they don't realize that tension is there sometimes to protect you, that it's, you know, containing something, and sometimes the tension may be a gift in a way. So just releasing it for the sake of releasing it, the tension out, you have to really question why something's tight. And for me, like, tightness is a parking brake of a car parked on a hill until proven otherwise. So she had released the tension and did not think to do some of the strategies that she was assigned afterwards to restabilize herself. And that's something I want to inspire you folks to really think about in these next two sessions, of questioning why something's tight before just assuming that it needs to be released. And I know as a chiropractor, I was just kind of taught release, 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 release. Anything is tight, release it. And I mean, sometimes it does help, and then sometimes it backfires. And so I think there's a way for us to do release work and understand the pelvic floor and its respective anatomy, what it is, what it isn't, and then also support why something is tight rather than cutting the brake line. Just putting that out there. So last week we talked about pelvic floor and the basic anatomy of the pelvic floor. Let me just pull out the handout that I usually share for this. And you know who I am at this point, and you know what to expect, so I'll skip all that. And let me just skip over to where we kind of left things off. We didn't get a chance to really talk about ligaments, but we did talk about the three parts of the pelvic floor, three major parts. We talked about puborectalis, pubococcygeus, iliococcygeus being part of the levator ani. We talked about coccygeus, and they combine to form this pelvic diaphragm, one of the seven anatomical diaphragms of the body. We talked about the innervation being from nerve to levator ani and nerve to coccygeus, which are basically from S4, S5. It's not pudendal nerve innervated as far as motor control. It's more, the pudendal nerve does play a part in it, which we'll talk about today. We talked about the urogenital hiatus and the anal hiatus, and you can see here the female. We compared that to the male, who has, of course, two major hiatuses, like the female, but there's only two things going through the hiatuses rather than three for the female, the people that are born female. We did talk about the difference between perineum and the pelvic floor, and so the depth level, we showed that. And so I also showed it to you in cross-section. This is a human cadaver patient that's plastinated. This is a von Hagen plastinate, and it is a male. You can see that this is the rectus abdominis seen from the posterior. This is the uracus connecting the midline linea alba area over to the urinary bladder. And then you can see the urinary bladder and prostate. And you can see the pelvic floor musculature here. Very, very thin structures. And then you can see the external rotators of the hip and some adductors to kind of fortify the inferiority of it. We talked about the vaginal uterine axis, and now we should get into ligaments. And so Ligaments are interesting. A lot of people think of them like attaching bone to bone, but ligaments to us in the pelvis, abdominal pelvis in general, tend to be like fasciae that condenses and collagenates in ways. And some of it is just fascia that stays fascia, but most of it is just collagenated fascia. And so that's an important thing to consider. And females have a lot more fascial elements because we have an extra organ that's behind the urinary bladder and in front of the rectum. So we have a little bit more of an intricate network. The puborectal ligaments are preventing the inferior movement and posterior movement of the organs along with the urethral pelvic ligaments. And so again, this is parietal peritoneum, which is connective tissue from embryonic development. And then we have this collagenation of it. Cardinal ligaments anchor the uterus, the cervix to the lateral part of the wall. And I've dissected this many times. The cardinal ligaments can become a little bit more lax. The suspensory ligament of the ovary doesn't really become lax as we age. This is largely parietal peritoneum that's enveloping the arterial supply to the ovary. The anal coccygeal ligament is huge. This is a very big deal. This ligament is what's basically attaching the puborectalis, pubococcygeus, iliococcygeus over to the coccyx. So they don't attach directly to the coccyx. They attach through this ligament. So this ligament doesn't become excessively lax. I don't actually find that in my cadaver patients, nor do I find it to be true in my patients. The anal coccygeal ligament does tend to get a little bit more solidified into a ligamentous structure as we age. The perineal body is what you hear about, where a lot of the perineal muscles are attached. And if the perineal body is basically between the urogenital hiatus and the anal hiatus, and this is a very important feature. We don't want this to tear because it destabilizes the urogenital diaphragm and the pelvic diaphragm. The uterosacral ligament you want to pay huge attention to. The uterosacral ligament is going to basically come from the upper back part of the cervix and project over to the third sacral segment. And this is one of your fixation procedures that they'll do. So they basically will try to pull the uterus and anchor it over to the sacrum. The surgery is done in the United States more than maybe other countries. You'll have to let me know what the data is in your country. But it has a very high fail rate. The tendinous arch of the pelvic fascia is basically on the lateral part of the pelvic floor and at the vaginal opening. And this is a thick arch of endopelvic fasciae that helps to support the vagina. The tendinous arch of levator ani, we talked about last week, that's actually obturator internus fascia. That's why we have a huge relationship with obturator internus and the pelvic floor. The supraspinous ligament, this is another fixation procedure. This ligament you'll see adjacent to the coccygeus muscle. And this allows passage of the pudendal nerve from the greater sciatic foramen to the lesser sciatic foramen. The sacrotuberous ligament, you guys probably already know, but the long head of the biceps femoris and semitendinosus attached to this, as well as gluteus maximus. So this guy is for force output and protection of things that pass from the greater and lesser sciatic foramina as well. So seeing some of this, if you guys have seen the uterus before, the suspensory ligament you can see here giving the blood vessels to the ovaries, this is called the broad ligament because it's a broad piece of peritoneum. And then little pieces of it condense like the uterosacral ligament right there. This is a huge part of preventing prolapse. So this is part of your vaginal uterine access. And this becomes very, very lax in people that have prolapse. That's why they do a fixation procedure there. This is my absolute favorite view. And I'm trying to get someone to make it for me in 3D, but because there's no models that I've seen that exist of this. And I've asked someone to 3D print it for me, but they said it's far too complicated. And that was a really interesting statement to me. I was like, you bet it's complicated. So you can see here, just to give you some orientation, the urinary bladder anteriorly towards the pubic bone. Here's the rectus abdominis. Right, here's the pubic bone here. Right here, I'm encircling the urinary bladder. Here's the uterus. So in a male, this would be missing, obviously. And then this is the rectum. And so you can see that projecting laterally are the fallopian tubes / uterine tubes. And so we have fasciae that anchors us to the wall on the sides, fasciae that anchors us posteriorly towards the sacrum, right? And then fasciae that anchors us over to the pubis. So this endopelvic fasciae, this condensation of parietal peritoneum also help us to anchor these ligaments. And what happens to us when we have a neurotransmitter decline, particularly of norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin, these structures can become very lax. It also happens when you lose estrogen, because estrogen is a vasodilator. It gets, you know, blood to be naturally flowing gently to these tissues. And then when you lose it, you start to lose the ability to have a nice proliferation of blood to tissues. And since fasciae, and especially ligamentous fasciae, is avascular in nature anyway, you need to make sure that you get some proper perfusion to the site. And so as these ligaments start to lose their good amount of tone, then things start to just collapse. And that's very common in prolapse, for these ligaments to lose their ability to maintain their natural state.
Kathy?
Yeah.
Some people have flagged this sound in the background. It seemed to be less distracting, but somehow has got more. Have you got headphones? You have some amazing headphones sometimes.
It's either this or a mask, folks. So I'm glad that you're willing to pause for a second. Is that better?
Yeah, much better.
Okay, great. So we'll get back to it then.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to gender differences, we need to have this discussion because males have more motor neurons in this onus nucleus that actually controls the pelvic floor than females do. Females have more fasciae, men have more muscles. So, and this is people that are born male and born female, obviously. And so this is actually really, really important. So this means that sex hormones play a role in our ability to prevent pelvic floor problems. And since we do have more fasciae and less total motor neurons, there are way more females that get motor control problems of the pelvic floor than males. And that's why you have like an influx of patients with that are female that have pelvic floor issues. And I think that is a huge statement and something to remember, not to mention the fact that things that we talked about last week. I feel it's really important to talk about the pudendal nerve and talk about sphincters versus pelvic floor and the pathways of the pudendal nerves. I think a lot of people have pudendal neuropathy and they think they have a pelvic floor problem. And those are different things. Remember that the pelvic floor has a fasciae underneath it that does get some pudendal nerve innervation and feed from the internal pudendal artery, but pudendal nerve is actually going to the perineum, to the posterior scrotum and labia majus, and to the anal triangle area. So it innervates the external urethral and external anal sphincters. So when you tell people to squeeze stuff, just know that you're actually activating pudendal nerve. And so the pudendal nerve does supply some, you know, pelvic floor strategy stuff through irradiation of the sphincters into the pelvic floor muscles, but the pelvic floor muscles, they're innervated for motor by the nerve to coccygeus and nerve to levator ani. So I think people get confused between the anatomy, and the anatomy is confusing because it's all very close, but I just want to show you the pudendal nerve pathway, and it's very treacherous. So if you have pudendal nerve pain, it tends to be anal, perineal, or clitoral or dorsal root of the penis in nature. And it's very close to the skin because the skin of that area is also innervated by the same nerves. So that's different, right, than having prolapse. So prolapse and pelvic ligaments have a big relationship to pelvic floor. Pudendal nerve does do some sensory innervation to this area that's confused with pelvic floor. So I do like to differentiate this for my patients and ask them what they're actually experiencing. Like, what is the awareness that you're experiencing? And so the S2, S3, S4 nerve roots kind of combine to form this, branches of them at least, combine to form this pudendal nerve. And do you guys see how this nerve passes adjacent to coccygeus, one of your pelvic floor muscles, and then it slips into this plane that you can't see anymore? See how it disappeared for a while? So you're seeing a blocked sacrospinous ligament. So this is one of the fixation procedures for people that have prolapse, right? That nerve goes adjacent to coccygeus and goes into the obturator internus fasciae. So you can see the obturator internus muscle here. This is on the lateral wall of the pelvis. You can see this is pubic symphysis anteriorly and sacrum posteriorly. And so these tissues are running between the sacral tubers and sacrospinous ligaments in the greater and lesser sciatic foramina. So they're in deep inside the buttock. So if people kind of point around the coccyx area between the coccyx and this and the ischial tuberosity, then I always kind of I'm suspect that it might be pudendal neuropathy that they're experiencing and not really a true pelvic floor problem. So you can see the pubic coccygeus has been cut away here so that you can see the full pathway. And this pathway is running adjacent to the pelvic floor and then running inferiorly to it. So you can see that here, here's the perineal membrane. And so this pudendal nerve is S2, S3, S4. And we always joke that S2, S3, S4 put pee and poo on the floor because they can actually control the sphincter movements. And so the sphincter movements are basically, they create and attach to the perineal body anteriorly and then to the anal coccygeal ligament posteriorly. So when someone activates the sphincters, they can get irradiation through the pelvic floor. That's why you have people telling you to hold your pee or hold your poo during release work or during activation work, conversely. So that's the anatomy of like how things are a little bit different and how they're the same. And so I do find that a lot of my patients with that come to me with pelvic floor diagnosed problems, a lot of them have pudendal neuropathy. And some of them just have pudendal neuropathy and don't have a true pelvic floor problem. And other people have an irradiation into the pelvic floor because of that co-attachment that they have to the anal coccygeal ligament. The effect of hormones, I found several research articles that a lot of people are not looking at hormones enough for treating pelvic floor problems. And there's this really good article on PubMed that talks about postmenopausal females being treated with either topical, which is more usually reliable, hormone therapies like estrogen to help with ligamentous tone so that you can prevent prolapse. Let's face it, a true pelvic floor problem usually is prolapse. I mean, if it's authentic pelvic floor and how it deals with ligaments. The reason why is that the pelvic floor muscles, they tend to retain, right? And if they lose retention, then you prolapse through the hiatuses. And so this is that whole complicated process, and I'll save you that. I can just send you this article if you'd like. This is me just basically abbreviating it. And it basically, just to sum it up for you, and we talked about it last week, is that the first thing that happens when you are perimenopausal and into menopause is that you start to lose estrogen. But the first sign is not vaginal dryness, it's actually discharge. And then you start to dry out the vaginal mucosa, and then you lose that vaginal uterine axis that we talked about last time, that ability to maintain continence. And so things can start to become incontinent, and you can also start to develop prolapse based upon hormones. So if you're not already co-caring with people that do hormonal work, it would be very wise. And I'm not just androgens. Androgens are what these articles are talking about here, but there's a huge, huge play for other things we'll talk about with neurotransmitters. Some of the signs of prolapse, I'm sure you guys already know, like heaviness and bulging pressures. I've had patients tell me that they use the bathroom, they have to push their rectum back up or push their bladder or uterus back up. That's usually a sign of a very, you know, significant, you know, prolapse. And so the quality of life can be really not fun because they find possibly sex difficult or defecation, urination to be a little bit traumatic because they're like, gosh, I just have to push my organs up all the time. And it's people that have prolapse that are usually considering the surgeries, right? The fixation surgeries. But you want to look at the relationship of bioidentical hormone or phytoestrogenic foods to kind of help with this stuff. It's not talked about nearly enough, and it definitely needs to be discussed with your patients that are experiencing prolapse. Where my practice has really come alive is talking about the receptors of neurotransmitters on the pelvic floor fasciae and the ligaments. So norepinephrine and dopamine are excitatory chemicals. Serotonin is an inhibitory chemical. And these chemicals actually have a major influence on pelvic ligaments because of because they control blood. Like norepinephrine depending on which type you are, beta A or beta B adrenergic, you can vasodilate and vasoconstrict. Serotonin is a vasoconstrictor, so it, you know, kind of increases blood pressure. And then dopamine plays a part in that also as an excitatory chemical that tends to encourage vasoconstriction. So I ask patients about, do you have to wake up to pee? You should never have to wake up to urinate. That's not a pelvic floor problem. That's a neurotransmitter problem that became a pelvic floor problem. And so a lot of my patients have neurotransmitter dysfunctions that, you know, some of it may be due to the blue light at nighttime. So I help them change their exposure to lights. Serotonin is really interesting. I'm seeing a lot of, when I run saliva and urine tests here in the States for this, I see a lot of people that are pretty bottomed out in the inhibitory chemicals. They have low serotonin, low GABA. I think I've only had one test out of 50 or 60 last year that I helped run that in my patients that had a normal serotonin and almost all of them had an elevated norepinephrine. So basically norepinephrine is a fancy way to say adrenaline, right? Dopamine can be either or depending on the patient, depending on their energy levels. But I loved these little, like, this is my favorite chart, like for you here on the right, to kind of show you what happens in this Venn diagram. If you have all three of the chemicals nice and balanced, mood and cognitive function is just quite excellent, right? But if you have just two, you can see that it doesn't really go well. Or if you have just one, it's you're definitely going to have some problems. So because these things control blood and because pelvic ligaments have a low blood supply, you really want to get them blood either through estrogen, which is a known vasodilator, or through balancing norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine to really give tonicity to the blood vessel. I mean, people are obsessed with fascia, right? And I understand the obsession. I'm obsessed with blood. And I've said this in many talks with Embodied Health. I'm 100% obsessed with what gets nerves are bloodthirsty, fascia is bloodthirsty, muscles are bloodthirsty, bone is bloodthirsty. And so ligaments and tendons aren't bloodthirsty, but if they lose blood, they really lose their ability to be able to do their job, which is why it's so hard to heal them. And so
There's a few questions mounting up. I just wanted to flag that. Do you want to deal with them now or wait
a few
minutes? So one might be simple. It came in, it says, is it vulvodynia?
Vulvodynia,
I can't pronounce it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Vulvodynia is pain in the perineal region, but it's kind of indescript. And so when someone is diagnosed with vulvodynia, I want to ask them more questions. Like, where do you actually feel the awareness? Is it inside the vagina? Because vulva technically is that whole area, right? So I ask them, you know, I have to ask them vaginal pain versus uterine pain versus perineal pain versus true pelvic floor pain. So you have to do an investigation and ask them the anatomy of their pain.
Cool. Nicola has asked, relating to your comment, Kathy, about neurotransmitter dysfunction leading to ligaments becoming lax, does this apply to MS as well? And in addition, if the loss of estrogen also contributes to ligaments becoming lax, does this mean that women postmenopausal who have MS and Parkinson's are higher at risk?
Yes and yes.
And Kath says, a physio I know has written a paper on the tethering of tight fascia of PF that's causing prolapse. She does internal MBO fascial work to release fascia and restore the elasticity of the bladder fascia. What's your thoughts on this?
I mean, I think you guys already know my thoughts on this or that. I don't think that people have to do direct work, and you're not doing direct work. If you go even into the vagina, you're going through the vaginal walls to touch anything. So I don't think internal work is necessary. I do zero internal work. I can by law. I just don't feel like it's necessary. I don't personally do it, but what I do is look at the neurotransmitters and make sure that things are getting blood. And then, as we'll discuss in hour three of the talk, I'll show you what I do to help stabilize the pelvic floor. And it's what we did as a baby. And I think that it's extremely effective without having to go internal. And nothing against going internal, but for the same reasons I told you about at the beginning of this talk, I think that if you just go internal and releasing fascia without stabilizing stuff, it can be just as injurious as it is helpful. So you have to be really careful. I think a really solid assessment process is really necessary. And as we discussed last time, the pelvic floor is a recipient of things like transverse abdominis, internal abdominal oblique, diaphragm pressures. So you have to be careful of thinking of it as a single entity, because it's not.
There's been a couple of requests to go a little more slowly. I know Kathy's courses are super rich and full.
Okay, we can cover less material, folks, if you want me to go more slowly. It is recorded, so I'm doing my best to try to get as much in as possible because it's what you asked for. So I can either go slowly and not cover as much, or I can go quickly and then you can rewatch it. So you guys tell me what you want and I'll do what you want. But I was trying to cover everything that you asked me for in the free talk.
Yeah.
Means, I mean, yeah, so... I can stop. Many you guys stop me to ask questions too, which means I can't cover as much material. So you guys tell me what you want.
Everyone says there's loads of people saying keep going as you are. Okay. And rewatch it.
Yeah, that's the good part about it being recorded. You can rewatch it. Yeah. It's me. Basically, I'm just telling you, like, look at neurotransmitters. And because I know you're going to ask questions, I'm just covering as much of it as possible. So you can always rewatch it and slow me down if you like. That's a popular choice.
Yeah, there's a vote. There's loads of people saying keep going as you are.
Okay, so. Great. We'll do.
Carry on. Thank you.
Oh, okay. More? Okay, great. So let's go back for a second. So my biggest, and I know that people are pretty freaked out by neurotransmitters and neuroanatomy in general. I love it. So basically what I'm saying is maybe develop a relationship with someone who orders saliva and urine testing. Maybe it's functional medicine, maybe it's osteo, whatever field around you is very comfortable with their neuroanatomy and looking at these scans. It's a really easy scan to do. It's very much like doing your DNA with 23andMe, your ancestry.com. You basically just do saliva tests and you look at relationships with cortisol. And what the urine and saliva give you that blood work doesn't is they give you metabolites, like what things were actually converted to. So I think it's a huge miss that we only look at estrogen with blood work. I mean, in the States, we don't even look at like serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine levels in people's saliva and urine before we put them on SSRIs and SNRIs or dopamine antagonists or agonists, which to me is shocking. We only use symptoms. To me, it's like, wait a minute, what? And so I am very, very big on saliva testing, urine testing. So because you can't just think of these, like people think of norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine. They think of them as mood chemicals. And of course they're mood chemicals, but they also control blood vessels. And I want you to get obsessed with blood as much as I'm obsessed with blood. Because if something's not getting adequate blood supply, it doesn't matter what you're really eating. If the neurotransmitters aren't getting it to the site, then you can't absorb it. And so the pelvic ligaments, you really, like, if I can get them to be more nourished, then maybe we won't need to do as much of this release work, is my point. And so, and again, I'm not against release work. I'm just saying that I think it's missing something, right? So, or there wouldn't be these patients that fail it so much like I did. So this is one of my patients that volunteered her data. She has pelvic floor disorder, and she has both a perineal, all three. She has a pudendal neuropathy on one side. She has a pelvic floor dysfunction on one side, and then she has perineal dysfunction on the side opposite. And so she's been a really interesting, challenging patient. She's so kind and wonderful to share this. So for her, she also had some of the mental symptoms, like she had, as you can see, very low serotonin level. This is extremely common. Low GABA. GABA is gamma-aminobutyric acid. It's an inhibitory chemical that balances out these excitatory chemicals. So think of these things as like stimulating blood to go, right? These things kind of sedate things to chill out, right? So inhibition, you know, slow down, like chill out, you know, the blood, this guy, you know, increase the blood flow, right? These are adrenergic mostly. So you can see that she even has like normal norepinephrine. This is her second scan with me. So we actually got that to normalize a bit, but her epinephrine's a little low and her dopamine was in the pooper. It was really, really low. So we do use nutritional therapies to get that to normalize up. And it really helped with her urinary continence. It helped with her painful sex. It was really, really great. Helped with her sleep, which is so wonderful. Notice that she has a high cortisol read in the mid-morning. And then she also has a high one before sleep. So that basically meant that her norepinephrine, epinephrine ratio was going to be altered. And so that basically means that she was waking up in the middle of the night to pee. And that's just, you know, not so good for people with a pelvic floor disorder. So again, we help to balance out the cortisol by having her not use blue light after 4. I had her use amber glasses and then, you know, red glasses at night. And then changed her bulbs to incandescent bulbs, like these little things that help to control cortisol and norepinephrine ratios. And not only did she sleep through the night, she, the supplements that we gave her were so, so helpful for her to have, you know, a less pain in her pelvic floor. So these are things that are not really talked about in medicine very much in the United States. And you guys can tell me if it's true where you live, but, you know, I have been the first person to mention this to a lot of my pelvic floor patients and they get so much benefit from it. So I'm like, what the heck? And, you know, along with your pelvic floor release therapies or your dilators or your jade eggs, can we also work on the actual neurology? And this is missing for a lot of people. And it's so, so helpful. So if you're not comfortable doing it, maybe get comfortable with someone doing it. You guys can always call me and I can send you a kit or whatever, but honestly, if you have someone near you, it's better. You can develop a relationship with them and you can refer patients back and forth. It's really, really great.
Kathy? So,
yeah, go ahead.
Angela has asked, what do you mean by nutritional therapy? Supplements or diet or both?
Yeah, both. Yeah, just whole food nutrition plus there's certain supplements that are precursors to neurotransmitters like 5-hydroxytryptophan for the inhibitory chemicals, sun-theanine, L-theanine, an amino acid that helps with inhibitory production. You can do certain things to sedate dopamine. So you need to see someone that's like a naturopath or someone who knows a lot about nutritional neurotherapies. Typically, those are functional medicine doctors or, you know, well-versed nutritionists. You just have to do some shopping and find out who will do it for you if you're not comfortable doing it for yourself. If you have the scope of practice to do it, I really hope that you'll do it, that you'll learn about it and study it. And it's actually not that complicated. These words are sound big because they're in Latin, norepinephrine and epinephrine, and it's not that bad. If you start getting Google happy, just type in norepinephrine and bladder control. Type in norepinephrine or dopamine and urinary incontinence. You're going to find a litany of things. It's not hard to find at all. Serotonin has been long linked to urinary incontinence. So remember, these ligaments have receptors as you know of these chemicals because they need the blood. So again, I'm just 100% obsessed with blood. So, because fascia needs blood, everything needs blood. So, especially the ligaments of the pelvis. So when it comes to supporting the pelvic floor, the ligaments holding everything up means that they're not falling down on the pelvic floor and the pelvic floor is not having to hold everything up. So you need to protect your ligaments along with your muscles.
Fantastic. The same person's asked about contraindications and dosage, but that would be down to the people with scope of practice to supplement and do dietary advice, would it not?
Yeah. And I think that I'm not an island, right? I'm very well versed in a lot of things, but I really love co-caring. I love co-caring with endocrinologists, surgeons, anybody that'll talk to me, basically. And as you start to open up those doors, you don't have to feel like you are the only solution for people. If it's not in your scope to do nutrition, or maybe it's not in your interest, maybe you're a fascial specialist and you just want to work on the internal work. What I'm trying to say to you is maybe you should also co-care with someone who does nutritional therapy because your results will be better, folks. If you get a richer blood for the person, then all the work that you're doing holds better. Like who doesn't want better outcomes, right? So I hope this inspires you to seek out some people that do have that scope if you don't have it.
Do you want a couple more? There's sure. Two more.
Yeah.
One's
Go
got
ahead.
Two parts. So Cassia says light bulbs, in years of PTSD and messed up chemicals that now I think I could be the reason for not great tissue quality in the pelvic area. Would this be reversible? I'm thinking again, the blood, enrich the blood.
Yes. I love how you asked that. Is this Cassia?
Cassia, yeah.
Cassia, yes. So my whole life I had a sleep disorder and no one put together that I had two sleep disorders as a child and it went into my adulthood. And so when I had my coccidial injury, I was wondering why do some people heal from coccidial injury so fast and others don't. And it wasn't put together to me until my 30s. I had a pelvic floor disorder from like a coccidial fall at 28 till 35. So 7 years. And it really, I don't want anyone to have to endure like that amount of time with a pelvic floor disorder. And I was blaming myself. Like, what am I not doing right? And it turns out it was multifactorial. Like my internal work, it was helpful while they were doing it, but it would just keep coming back. And it was really, really frustrating because I was like, am I doing something wrong in between sessions? And then I started looking at the neurotransmitters. I started looking at functional movement strategies, which we'll talk about next week. And the combination of all those things meant better sleep, better continence, better pelvic tissue quality, less chances of me developing prolapse later, because I'm, you know, 5 or 6 years from menopause, right? So I'm thinking of all of that now. And I'm really excited that you said, you know, I've never linked my mood disorder or my sleep disorder to my pelvic ligamentous health. You should, because it's all about the blood.
Awesome. Alyssa, so there's Kaisa. I don't know. Anyway, that one was, this one's Alyssa. Dr. Dooley, I cannot find my notes from last week. Two questions.
Okay.
So tell us if you covered these last week, in which case we can move on. Otherwise,
no, it's okay. Go ahead.
Number one, was it mentioned when muscular feed is lost, muscles become more ligamentous or rigid or atrophied?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is muscle feed loss, meaning the blood thirstiness of muscles is not met via poor movement and neurotransmitters? If not correct, please correct. And then there's a second question.
Okay, so should I handle the first part of that question? So the first part of the question is, when muscles start to lose, are they replaced with atrophy? Well, that's natural for any muscle. These are type 1A fibers, so they are always have a little bit of tension and tone into them. So they are more likely to collagenate and become more ligamentous when they are no longer used. And we did talk about that last week. So I talked about the coccygeus and how it usually shows up ligamentous in the elderly. So yeah, you start to lose some of your motor control, if you will, from a voluntary standpoint. and it becomes a little bit more stiff tissue. And then there was a second part she was asking about.
Is muscle feed loss, meaning the bloodthirstiness of the muscles is not met via poor movement or neurotransmitters? If not correct, please correct.
No, I think that you're right. I think that what I love about movement therapy, what I love about the fascial work, what I love about massage is that it moves blood. So when it comes to exercise, breathing training, all of it, it moves blood so that things can get proliferated with their nutrition that they need. And the neurotransmitters control that. So you're right. Like if you have a neurotransmitter balance, then you can vasodilate, vasoconstrict, and you can supply what's needed. Can you think about the people that, like some of my patients, that they think that doing more exercise is better. So they'll do a lot of exercise and then they'll pee themselves because they have a pelvic floor disorder. And I'm like, you didn't do anything bad. You just met your limit. And if we start to, you know, ease you into your stability training along with improving circulation through the neurotransmitters, it means that you have a win-win situation, but more is not better. And so if you get them out of that more is better feeling and get them into better is better, and usually less is more. And so I tell them, you know, you got to not speed through your yellow lights. You got to recognize the yellow light and back off. And so that you can, you know, provide enough stability for the pelvic floor as well as the circulation and controlling that, and just take time. But it doesn't take as much time if you handle all of it. Like if you start dealing with the neurotransmitters and improving people's sleep along with understanding the anatomy a little bit better and providing stability training along with the mobility work that you might be doing passively, you match the active and the passive, and that activates more circulation to the site. So I think that you're right.
Cool. And she's got a good second question. This might be interesting for many people. Lots of videos on this on YouTube and such. What are your thoughts with squatting culture versus pelvic muscle and pelvic muscle health versus sitting on a chair and toilet?
Ask me next week.
Next week. Okay.
Because we're covering the movement portion next week. And I have a lot of opinions about this for my pelvic floor patients. The short and simple is, I don't think the squat should be the first thing you would choose. I think quadruped would be the first thing I would choose. And so a lot of people don't have spinal stabilization to be able to support the sacrum and the nerves that come out of it. And so they get entanglement of pudendal nerve, they get entanglement of nerve to coccygeus, they actually impede the blood supply, and they kind of encourage squatting. And we don't do that in ID. We encourage lunging. So I'll talk more about that next week.
I'm wondering if there's a confusion. Is she not talking about squatting to go to the toilet
as opposed to
sitting on a toilet or anyway, clarify that, Alyssa.
I'm assuming she means like squatty potty, which we'll talk about.
Like, yeah, those squat stools to raise your knees.
Yeah.
And squatting.
Yeah. Squatty potty is highly improved. It's highly improved, but not so much for the pelvic floor itself as much as the rectum. And urinary bladder being vertical, because a traditional toilet has you sit like backwards in a hinge. And so you have your pee and poo has to go like, it has to go at a huge angle rather than vertical. So squatty potties tend to be pretty effective for that. Just put yoga blocks under your feet if you don't have a squatty potty.
And Darina Patton has suggested you can use acupuncture points for balance. Sure. Blood,
I'm an acupuncturist, so yep.
Cool.
You can use a lot of things. Yeah, acupuncture is a wonderful tool to help with that as well. Yep.
Yeah, cool.
Great.
That's it for now.
Okay, wonderful. So surgical repairs. I wanted to hit that before we go into the movement section next week. The surgical repairs have a really high fail rate. And it's not because the surgeons aren't wonderful, just like you guys are wonderful myofascial specialists. It's because there needs to be a multidisciplinary approach, and it usually is missing. We need to all be working together to provide a very holistic treatment of the patient. So what will end up happening, and we kind of describe this a little bit, like you start to like get like sagging and movement through the vaginal canal, through things like the uterus, the rectum, the urinary bladder, things will just start to collapse through respective hiatuses of the pelvic floor. So very important to understand that some of your patients do have sling procedures. They do have problems from these procedures. And not only do they have a high fail rate as far as prolapse, but they have a lot of, there's a lot of, in the United States, there's a lot of malpractice suits and just lawsuits associated with a very, very not effective procedure. So there's some huge warnings of the complications of these surgeries. You're very well warned that all of these things might happen. Like your bladder may be overactive now. Like you're dealing with prolapse, and now you also have, you know, incontinence. It might have stop and start urination. It may be really challenging because of scar tissue formation or disruption of those neurotransmitters we were talking about, disruption of their receptors. The slings may actually come through the hiatuses, which happens to some of my patients, where they can actually feel some of the tissues actually fall through that were trying to hold things up. Just very disconcerting. Just perineus is painful sex, and then just pain associated with it. So I try to tell my patients to do everything they can before they go into surgery. And if they do, like some people come to me for post-surgical rehabilitation after these procedures. And so look at what it says here, folks. This article says a multidisciplinary approach is not only essential, but also critical. So if you're having sacrospinous ligamentous fixation or uterosacral ligamentous fixation, you're having, you may have to do other things like pessaries. You may have to do physiotherapy, biofeedback, pharmacotherapy, and there comes your neurotransmitters. So you might have to do extra stuff. And I highly suggest doing as many things as you find efficacious for the patient to help. And there's where your co-caring is, multidisciplinary. So I could not recommend co-caring enough. This is just showing some schematics of what you have to do. Like basically for a uterosacral fixation, you have to kind of pull, they basically sling and pull towards the sacrum, and it just starts to fall. It's not a procedure that has a really high success rate. Here, you can see it here going through the vagina and then coming over to through the uterus and then anchoring from the cervix over to the sacrum. So it's not super successful. So the sacrospinous ligament fixation is another one with a lot, you can see here in purple, complications have produced extensive lawsuits in the United States. The meshing, people reject the mesh that's used, 70% fail rate and 5-year point. So very, you know, it's just not super great. And a lot of these patients have to get an additional surgery. So I don't know. Maybe we should do as many things as possible to prevent this. And then also, if someone gets this, support them with multidisciplinary approaches. It's not just females though, folks. Prostatectomy. I just had a telehealth visit a couple of nights ago with someone who had the TURP procedure, which is a transurethral resection of the prostate. That's what TURP stands for. And so they basically go through the urethra in order to resect pieces of the prostate. And because of that, you have to breach the pelvic floor. So you can see here, the pelvic floor is supporting us. And because of that, they may have scar tissue around that area, a hard knot felt at the root of the penis where the prostate is kind of just superior to it. And so yeah, I think I told you guys last week that I've had like an influx of of males that have had this procedure, and a lot of them have erectile dysfunction due to the disruption of the blood flow from pudendal to this region, and incontinence because of the pelvic floor dysfunction, and sterility, lymphedema, the like. So I do couple a lot of like lymphatic work that we talked about in the lymphatic course, along with some of the amazing movement strategies I think that are so helpful. And if you are, you had said that you were interested in it, so I mentioned it here, vaginoplasty and phalloplasty. We talk about those two things too, because they are pelvic floor surgeries. So in the region, I'm sorry, the perineal area, and involve the pelvic floor input and output. You're basically changing the anatomy. This is male to female vaginoplasty. So you basically, you are creating this amazing vaginal opening by cutting open the root of the penis and that area in the perineum. So you can see that in order to do this, you have to really push against the pelvic floor and as you're opening up the perineum. So these patients need a lot of your support to improve blood flow, to decrease infectious risk, and to make sure I think a lot of people reject the tissue because they don't have good blood flow here. So maybe we can encourage the blood flow through movement strategies, through neurotransmitter therapies, through fascial therapies. There's so many things that can be done. And so I think this group of this population, at least in the United States, has not been classically really supported in pelvic floor therapy. And it's a growing thing. So with gender affirmation surgeries, I'm really excited to work with patients that have experienced this. So this is phalloplasty. They usually use brachial skin to create a phallus. And so for this one, I haven't found that phalloplasty has as big of an impact, because usually what they'll do with vaginal opening is they'll do a sew, and there's not a huge amount of internal work. A lot of it's more external for obvious reasons. So, and they will build like a tube for the urethra to connect to the external urethral sphincter for the female. And so the female to the male, phalloplasty is a really interesting procedure with a little less total pelvic floor dysfunction because of it, but both, you need to treat both, because this one has a higher risk of urethral fistulas, a lot of urinary problems and pelvic bleeding associated with this one. So if you're, and I wanted to mention it because you guys were so interested in it. And so I'm glad that you guys are, because this is a population that's underserved. And so they really need our help. Before we take more questions, I just wanted to talk about what happens when you breach the pelvic floor. What are some ways that we breach it? And you guys know about a lot of these already, but episiotomy is when you cut the vaginal opening a little bit wider open so that you can allow for the passage of a baby's head. Sexual trauma, this can be just, you know, sex that's actually you agreed to, but it's also sexual trauma from people who have not agreed to it. So consensual versus non-consensual sexual trauma is something that you can definitely ask about if you feel comfortable with it. Birthing traumas are fall into the episiotomy category, but you don't have to have an episiotomy. Some people full on tear. So you definitely want, you know, information on what actually happened post-parturition ultrasounds, anything that you have, any information. Prolapse, hysterectomy, oophorectomy is removal of the ovaries. Estrogen, progesterone receptors in the female urinary tract, we talked about that, fluctuating during menstruation and menopause. So I actually gave a talk on how women's training should change, like for movement training should change versus different parts of their period. And so that is something I use to help train how hard I go, what choices I make, because these receptors are all along the urinary pathway. Scarring is like very present in PCOS, pelvic inflammatory disease, irritable bowel syndrome. I'm working with a patient right now that had a small bowel obstruction. And so he's got a lot of pelvic floor dysfunction from that as well. So you can ask people about, hey, did you have any abdominal resections? If they have this in their history, then you might want to assume that they might need some pelvic floor work, especially if it was things that are in the false or true pelvis, like the small intestine and large intestine. The chronic constipation is no friend to the pelvic floor. There's a lot of pressure on it. Hemorrhoids. I work with a ton of people with hemorrhoids. I consider that part of the pelvic floor, pathology. Use of like menstrual products like diaphragms, cups, tampons, they play a role in pelvic floor health. Anal fissures are a big one too, that, you know, it's tough for people to talk about because they're so uncomfortable. A lot of people have these surgeries done over and over and over again to drain the fissure from its pus. We talked about prostatectomy, neurological disorders like MS. I think people have been asking me a lot about MS and Parkinson's, and I just hadn't gotten there yet. Definitely, if you have neurotransmitter dysfunction or if you have bradykinesia, dyskinesia, it makes things more challenging because the motor control is harder. And then long head biceps, tendon, sacral tuberous, and spinous ligamentous strains, people that have injuries to the buttocks and in the area that supports the pelvic floor, these can all be included. The major functions of the pelvic floor, I know we talked about it already, but what does it do? It's number one, it mostly does pelvic organ support. It does bladder and bowel control. It does pregnancy for child and child birthing. It supports the breathing apparatus, although it itself can't breathe, sexual function. And then of course, just letting everything out as well as letting things in. And so that's the bulk of what I wanted to discuss this week, along with just reminding you, like, we're not quite sure what exactly the pelvic floor does besides those things. We do know that the pelvic floor changes in lots of different activities. Like, it'll be different from standing and walking than speaking, coughing, singing, like different. We do know that there's like different firing patterns for them, but the fact that we're upright, that we have huge heads and that we really want to support the pelvic viscera when we're upright means that we have to resist and maintain intra-abdominal pressure. And so intra-abdominal pressure, I hope, becomes the management of it becomes a big part of what you do along with your manual therapies, along with your nutritional therapies. It's so important to help people learn how to build intra-abdominal pressure and how to release it. So we'll talk about that a little bit more next time, because I want to get into movement strategies and show you guys what we can do to help people through movement. And I think that if you did those after some of your activities, I think it could really help. And I know we talked about this already, but please remember that these fibers are type 1 fibers. So cueing them to kind of like squeeze all the time is not going to be it. So that's why I think that a lot of people fail the Kegel thing. The type 2 fibers are sphincters. Right? The sphincters do have a connection to the anal coccygeal ligament, especially the external anal sphincter. So it's not bad to give those cues. It's just incomplete. And so teaching them how to basically create and release intra-abdominal pressure through other muscles like transverse abdominis, internal abdominal oblique, external abdominal oblique, rectus abdominis, thoracic diaphragm, multifidus, lumbar erectors, these major, major muscles of building and release of gut pressure support the pelvic floor. So if you're not doing that already, you gotta start. It is a huge part of my clinical practice to remind people that a lot of those muscles that we named have a lot of type 2 fibers and can be trained a lot easier than the pelvic floor, which is type 1. And that's the bulk of what I wanted to cover today as far as the anatomy. So I'd love to take some questions based upon some of the new stuff we talked about this week, ligaments, neurotransmitters, the type of fibers in the pelvic floor, surgeries.
Yeah, what more questions are out there? Kian shared some stuff, my colleague here in Portugal, bant.org.uk for finding nutritional therapists. This is for the UK.
Oh, thank you.
Someone was asking, how can we get bloods and be supported in co-care within the UK? A lot of our members are UK-based. Nuffieldhealth.com/pathology-direct. The link is in the chat. I can get the link for anybody who wants it, but I'm just speaking it for people who are watching the recording and don't see that. So Nuffieldhealth, N-U-F-F-I-E-L-D, health.com/pathology-direct. You can get some contacts there for co-caring people with people. Alison has mentioned and asked, would cesarean section affect pelvic breach?
Mentioned intra-abdominal pressure. Yeah, we talked about it last week, and we'll definitely talk about it again next week. So yeah, of course. Remember how we talked about transverse abdominis and internal abdominal oblique, and they're adjacent to the pelvic floor, and the pelvic floor receives its cue from them. And so if diaphragm, TVA, and IAO are the builders and releasers of gut pressure, the true big builders and releasers of gut pressure, because they attach to the ribs, right? So TVA and IAO through chondroit tendon, through their attachment to the pubic crest, the pubic coccygeus is right behind that. So it's like waiting for the cue of what to do. It's like getting the baton pass from TVA and IAO. So it's really crucial to remember that in C-section, they cut through that chondroit tendon bilaterally. So we have to rehabilitate that. I've written an article about it. I can send to you if you just email me. I can say it's called C-section and how it steals your strength.
If you email it to us, Kathy, I can put it in the course area for them.
Yeah, great. Just shoot me a reminder.
And more information for UK practitioners. Nicola says the vaginal mesh was temporarily banned in the UK, has been, the ban was lifted in 2019, but now has strict conditions imposed upon it for implementation.
Yeah, it has a huge failure rate and people have a lot of adverse effects. So gosh, it does not inspire you to want to do anything you can to not do that mesh. Or to support them afterwards. Maybe it fails so much because we don't do any of the movement therapies. We don't suggest people get myofascial therapies afterwards. We don't suggest that they get pelvic floor therapy. We don't suggest that they do physical therapy. Like, it's such a strange thing. Like, hey, let's put the mesh in and now you're good. I mean, I've had patients tell me like they were not suggested to get any therapy afterwards. And I'm like, what? That is to me like a way to set you up for failure with the surgery. Don't you want the surgery to be successful? Like it says right there in that that meta-analysis that I showed you guys, that a multidisciplinary approach improves the surgical outcomes. So let's improve their surgical, let's make the surgeons look good, shall we?
There was a documentary showing the US industry of those mesh sales and the lack of information provided. So I guess a lot of those lawsuits were as a result of the kind of misinformation and sales tactics of these private companies administering private medical. I can't remember what the documentary, maybe if someone.
I would love to see that. I have not seen that. And I would be equally excited and infuriated to watch that.
Yeah, it was informing and upsetting. And if anybody remembers the name, I'll try and find it as well. So Katie's asking, your friend Katie. Asking about what foods do you suggest for hormonal rebalancing post-menopause?
It depends on the person. You got to run that profile. So you can assume that estrogen and progesterone are going to drop, of course, during menopause. So my easy answer is phytoestrogenic foods, right? And then a lot of those like tofu gets a really bad rap because there's some research articles that, you know, support that soy isolates have carcinogenic activity, and you're not eating soy isolates when you're eating tofu and edamame. And so if you get non-GMO organic sourced, you know, phytoestrogenic food, it can actually play a huge part. And there's a litany of foods, but you can't just give a bucket answer to that. You have to run the profile. You have to see what their norepinephrine, dopamine, serotonin, because estrogen competes with norepinephrine, and estrogen also is synergistic to serotonin. So you have to be really, really careful about just saying, hey, try this food. It really is based upon the person. So for my general statement is, you know, of course, include, you know, whole food, phytoestrogenic foods. That would be a wonderful thing, but that's just assuming that everyone with menopause is low on estrogen. Treat the individual.
Sorry. Treat the individual. Yeah.
Yeah.
In Portugal, there are tons of blood labs everywhere. Like
Every
street, every main high street corner, they're everywhere.
Blood and saliva and urine all. Remember, none of those are standalone. And then one test is not what you look at. You have to get tested on a regular 3 to 6 months. You know, for me, I do every 6 months, but I probably should do it every 3 months. But I'm just not... have not been as disciplined to do that as of late because of my busy schedule. And it's a terrible excuse. So, but I would suggest that people do it, you know, at least every half year and do all three. You want to compare all three because remember, blood is bound in free hormone and urine and saliva is how they are metabolized. So you can't really get a good read with one without the other. Mm-hmm. So make sure you have all three.
Cool. Good advice, Nicola. So we have, this webinar was applicable for birth practitioners. Clearly, we have some doulas and midwives in here. And
awesome.
One is asking, during childbirth, is it more beneficial to be able to relax the type 1 fibers as they are always tonic? More tension is surely likely to increase the risk of damage? In addition, would hypnobirthing techniques help this to increase the relaxation hormones, e.g. serotonin, etc., to relax type 1 fibers?
I'm a huge fan of hypnobirthing. I think I really think the push thing is what gets a lot of people tears. And a lot of doulas and midwives might disagree with me on that because they are closer to the project. But I think we got to be really careful with, first of all, set up the female with success. If she's going to have to push, which is, you know, happens, and maybe she's coached into it because it's effective. We want to make sure that she, her pelvic floor is primed. I agree that the, you're not gonna be able to relax the type one fibers, by the way. Type one fibers are always going to be tonus. So we have to get away from that idea of like, hey, relax the type one fibers. But I do agree with you, like that pulling up that people do, like they're trying to constrict and like, it's not a good idea. And so, I think that we can work a lot with trying to create femoral movement with hypnotherapy or hypnobirthing. It is wonderful because it puts them in a more relaxed breathing state, a better wave, a brain wave where they're not as anxious. Because remember, norepinephrine again will misbalance GABA and serotonin. And I think that a couple of my patients are experiencing, they're practicing the hypnobirthing techniques with their midwives and doulas. And it's way more popular in the UK than it is in the US. So my patients in the UK, we do telehealth. So she's had such a wonderful pregnancy and she's, you know, a couple of weeks out and she's really excited about what hypnobirthing has done for her, just in her everyday life, just practicing breathing. And she said her sex is more enjoyable and like, it's so great to have so many great things controlling the neurotransmitters. It's not just about nutritional therapy for neurotransmitters, as we'll talk next week. It's about breathing training, and hypnobirthing is a lot of quality breathing training. So I couldn't recommend that enough.
Breathing for blood chemistry, alkalosis.
Now you better believe it.
Yeah. Like Leon Chaito said.
Oh my gosh, genius. That. His little chart, his anxiety chart.
Yeah.
Sent that to my husband yesterday.
We've got, if you're a member of eHealth, we've got Leon Chaito going through all that stuff in our archive.
Oh my God. You guys are so lucky. Like, what a genius.
Yeah. Kathy, will you talk about the perineal body anatomy and tears and how they look? Tears.
Oh, we talked about the perineal body anatomy last time, right? With the perineum, it's right between the root of the penis and vagina. And it really is just a dense piece of tissue. And so we talked about last time how, like, if it's damaged, then the entire pelvic floor, not the pelvic floor, the perineum, can be destabilized. And so that the inferior support of the pelvic floor, that buttress of fibrous tissue that kind of supports it, kind of collapses a little bit. So it encourages prolapse.
Will you cover how to help people with hemorrhoids, please?
Sure, if you want, if we have time.
Any thoughts on laser treatment to the vaginal wall for treating incontinence being promoted by urogynecologists?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I had a patient that had it done recently. She had a really negative response. And then I have other patients that have a positive response. So right now it's kind of a coin toss, which I don't like. I'd rather see a little bit more positivity in the data of the laser therapies. Cause I mean, laser's burning, folks. I mean, we do have to singe tissue. And so it's a form of cauterization, right? So I think that you should really investigate whether their tissue heals quickly, like if they want to go down that route, or if maybe they want to do some less invasive things first.
Right. There's a one in the Q&A, which I have to click on another thing. What are your thoughts on HRT? I think you mentioned something that last week.
With what? I'm sorry.
Hormone replacement therapy.
Oh, I tend to want to push people towards bioidentical hormone and food therapies before they would do the traditional type of hormone replacement, because there's so many side effects associated with hormone replacement. So the big focus for pelvic floor is going to be estrogen. There's a lot of research on estrogen therapies helping with pelvic floor dysfunction. And so the problem, of course, is that when you take exogenous estrogen, you increase your chance of breast cancer risk. So it's like robbing one area to pay another area. So I think, like, okay, what can we do from a more natural standpoint so that the body doesn't fight with this aromatase activity and activation of particular genes and people? Like, do people with BRCA have to suffer from pelvic floor disorders because they can't take HRT, or can we actually use food and, you know, Chinese medicine, things that, you know, fight, you know, phytoestrogenic things instead of using exogenous hormones? Synthetic hormones are always kind of have a strange reaction in the body. they are coupled with adversity. Mm. The body's like, what is this? You're changing my anatomy. So I think that more gentle approaches may be used first before you jump the HRT bandwagon.
Cool. Do you have time for a couple more questions, Kathy?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention as well, Leon Chaito's webinar was very dense and fantastic. I did another webinar myself on Leon's methods for addressing blood chemistry and slowed down and went through three or four ways to do work with the breath. So you can check
That's wonderful.
Yay. You can check out breathing, search in the archive for breathing, and you'll see more than just Leon's fantastic one. He was my teacher. So do you believe in genetic predisposition for tissue laxity?
Sure. You don't have to believe in it. It's actually documented. It's not a theology. It's true. Yeah. It's, you know, but I do believe too, and something that's also proven is that you're not a slave to your genetics, folks. You know, Watson and Crick talked about like genes are expressed due to their environment. So like, just because you have a genetic predisposition towards something, like my patients that have Ehlers-Danlos or, you know, POTS, whatever, I tell them, you know, fortify that with the environment that you're in, improve strength. And that's a big focus next week, is that a lot of my pelvic floor patients are lacking mobility, stability, and strength in an even trifecta. And then you add that to an overload principle and they tend to crumble underneath an unstable platform. So, you know, yeah, you don't have to believe in tissue typing. It exists. Mm. Whether or not, like I have, you know, a particular type of genetic tissue type where I'm just like crazy flexible and I don't really want to show you, but I've coupled that with stability and strength and I don't push into my mobility. I support my mobility and it ended up being a very big part of my pelvic floor treatments.
Fantastic.
More effective, yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of our other teachers, Joanne Averson, has hypermobility and is a yoga teacher. And we've got webinars on tissue laxity and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and things in our archive as well. If people want to go check out ways to support bringing strength and stability back to people with hyper flexibility. There's another birth question. comment on the birthing question. From my understanding, proper tone in the muscles involved will help correct baby rotation by providing counter pressure during contractions, which then helps baby turn. This is one of the reasons for malpositions and epidurals, as these muscles are anesthetized. Do you agree?
I think it's abdominal lumbopelvic, not just pelvic. But yes, I agree with you. I've helped, we use our ID techniques to help people's babies turns all the time. Like, I know you guys probably use acupuncture also, like the UB channel stuff, but like, we use our pendulums, our abdominal pendulums to help get babies to move. People come to me and their babies are sitting in transverse and they're, you know, weak out and they want the head, they want everything to a face correctly, or baby's been sitting in a quadrant and they're worried about what's going to happen on game day. And so we, you know, analyze them as if they're anybody else and say, hey, how's your intra-abdominal pressure? Let's make sure that you can build it and release it. That's going to be a big part of your breathing part of labor. And let's see if we can get this kid to turn, because you know, he needs to efface. And if he's stuck in a position because mama's stuck, because she can't breathe through the right quadrant, then let's get her breathing through the right quadrant. And so, you know, we're really, really big on that. So I'm glad that you brought that up. And that is a big part of supporting the pelvic floor, is quality, generally symmetrical intra-abdominal pressure.
Do you recommend Leon's pelvic pain book, Kathy?
Love that book. Mm. His chronic pain. Oh my gosh, it's so good. Diane Lee, her book on pelvic disorders is fantastic. Those are my two go-tos. Those are my two favorites. And I don't like to play favorites because I have a lot of books on pelvic disorders, but those are the two that I resource the most. Diane Lee's work and Leon Chaito's work, I feel like they can't be beat. These two are just, have dedicated, Leon dedicated his life to really, you know, promoting and understanding breathing disorders and pelvic floor disorders and pelvic disorders in general. And then Diane also with pelvic floor and pelvic disorders. Both of those books are just out of this world.
Fantastic. So thank you everyone for all your comments and participation and enthusiasm for this topic. And thank you for yours, Kathy.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you so much. We'll see you next week for the final part, and people bring your questions to Kathy for next week. And we're going to address what to do about all this stuff and how to bring in the practical support that we can.
Yeah. Offer. Get ready to move around. I'm going to be in workout clothes. I suggest you do it as well, because we're going to get on the move. Okay. To really understand, we can't just talk about the anatomy. We've got to put the anatomy into motion. We've got to do it together as a family. So, you know, use some, like wear some loose clothes, like some workout clothes, because you're going to be on the ground, like rolling around and doing stuff. So we don't want you in like a tight suit or something. So I think you guys are on lockdown anyway. So you're probably going to be in your jammies. So come in your jammies.
Cool. Thank you, Kathy. Wonderful.
Thank you guys for your amazing questions. And as you watch the playback and more questions spark up, just write them down and we'll cover them next week.
Awesome. Thank you, everyone. Good night. Good night, Kathy.
Bye. See you next week.